attorney from the Department of Justice requires attorneys who have filed an antitrust class action suit on behalf of a natural person to give within 30 days of the complaint the Attorney General written notice of the action and a copy of the complaint.
Thank you. We have three people signed up here for this bill, and all three are signed up in favor, so maybe we could have them all come up. They're already here, my goodness. You people move fast in Senate Judiciary. So please, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Fred Voss, and I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 215. Senate Bill 215, as described, requires that plaintiff class action attorneys provide notice to the Oregon Attorney General's office when they file a class action lawsuit on behalf of consumers alleging violations of the Oregon Antitrust Act and when class action attorneys settle the class action. This would, at that point, allow the Attorney General of Oregon to intervene into the class action to ensure that the settlement for the Oregon consumers would be fair, reasonable, and adequate. This legislative proposal is derived from the Illinois BRIC Interim Study Report, committee report, and that committee unanimously agreed to support this legislation. At this time, I would like to turn the microphone over to former Assistant Attorney General Andy Albertine, who was the Oregon Department of Justice representative on that work group.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and the members of the committee, my name is Andy Albertine. I'm an attorney for the Albertine Law Firm. Prior to that, I was an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice from 1989 to 2003. And for almost all of that time, I was the lead antitrust lawyer for the Oregon Department of Justice and working on a number of different bills and legislation, as well as antitrust cases, state and federal. Mr. Boss is correct that this particular bill arose out of an interim committee involving the Illinois BRIC repealer statute, and one of the things that each committee member had agreed upon unanimously, in fact, that there was a need in some instances for the Attorney General to perhaps have a role in some of these class action settlements, even though the Attorney General was not a party to the action. As by way of background, there are a number of class action matters in antitrust that do not involve the Attorney General as a plaintiff, but do involve consumers, Oregonians, who are represented by private counsel. And for the most part, most of the settlements are fair and adequate and reasonable and do the job in resolving the matters on behalf of the class members and a fair resolution for everyone. Those matters are submitted to the court. The court reviews the settlement, and then if the court also believes the settlement is fair and adequate, the settlement will be approved. What this bill does, and perhaps maybe the best way of putting it is, let's start with what this bill doesn't do. This bill does not change any of the substantive law of antitrust, either under the state law. The state does not change any of the rights that the plaintiffs or the defendants or the class members may have. It doesn't change the standards of proof. It doesn't change the amount of damages or the type of injunctive relief that the plaintiffs could receive if they were to prove a violation. And it doesn't change any of the procedural requirements that each party must adhere to during the course of any litigation. What this is a procedural bill designed specifically to address the very end of the case when the matter has been settled, and now we are looking simply to see whether that settlement is fair and adequate and reasonable for the class members. It is, for that reason, a consumer protection bill. It is designed to give the Attorney General notice of and an opportunity to make sure that class members are treated adequately and fairly. Specifically, and I can just cite a couple of examples of the types of things that the Attorney General would look for in the bill, is the form of the relief. For example, are consumers getting money back for the damages that they suffered, or are they getting something along the lines of coupons? Coupons perhaps to cash in to purchase the next product that is sold by the defendant. And if that sounds a little strange to you, in fact, that has happened on a number of occasions where the consumers of the class were to receive coupons in order to steer the consumer back to the very company that had been in violation of the law, while the attorneys received millions of dollars in attorney's fees. And those are the kinds of cases that have been reviewed in the past by government agencies, specifically the attorneys general in other states and other cases. We've cited to those. And those are the kind of cases that I believe would be the subject of the review by the attorney general here, to focus on the amount of fees and the type of relief for consumers. It's an extension of what the attorneys general have been doing behind the scenes for years, particularly in those cases where the attorneys general have been working as plaintiffs side by side with class lawyers. In my personal experience, and I've seen the attorneys general and their representatives from other states, when we do get to the point of settlement, the attorneys general act as an influence to make sure that the greatest amount of the money that is passing hands as part of the settlement goes to the class, and that the attorney's fees are fair, and we try to keep those fees as low as possible. That's important because some of these council fee awards in some cases extend or go up to perhaps 25 or 30% of the entire award, and that's a significant amount of money. So it's important, and I think the attorneys general have played a very, very important role in the past informally behind the scenes on this, and this is just another mechanism by which the Oregon attorney general, can do the same for class settlements involving Oregonians. Finally, this is not a novel concept. A number of other states, at least 12 other states, have some form of this type of notice at the front end in terms of the complaint and at the back end to ensure that the attorney general has the opportunity to review the settlement. That is essentially the basis of my testimony and why I am here. My law firm is here supporting the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee members may have.
Any questions, Mr. Senator Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Albertine, does the Attorney General charge the members of the class for its review of the settlement?
The Attorney General does not charge the members of the class for the review of the settlement. This is a matter where the Attorney General has the opportunity to look at the bill or look at the settlement, decide whether to weigh in, and in some instances, perhaps in the most instances, the Attorney General will conclude that there is not the need for the Attorney General to make an appearance or any sort of formal statement on the record. Whatever the decision is by the Attorney General, that doesn't play out in terms of charging the class members.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair. The Attorney General, the State of Oregon, gets 50% of all punitive damages in any lawsuit. Isn't that correct?
That is correct with the vast majority of the laws. It is not correct with respect to the antitrust awards because the antitrust awards deal with damages that can be trebled, but the trebling of the damages go all to the class members if in fact the matter went completely through trial and to judgment. In the vast majority of instances, over 90% of the instances, these matters get settled, and the amount of money that is paid over are considered damages to the class, and that's what goes directly to the class. The Attorney General gets none of that.
Madam Chair, Falcon? Thank you. The last comment that I would have is that then this purely is a consumer interest on the part of the AG and not a monetary one because there's no money to be gained and the AG is simply looking out for the consumers of the state of Oregon.
That's absolutely right. And also to address criticisms from time to time about class actions generally.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Was there discussion as to why this would apply only to antitrust class actions?
Chairman Burdick, Senator Ringo, the issue was addressed in the context of the Illinois BRIC Interim Committee. The Interim Committee was addressing the concept of whether an indirect purchaser law made sense or not. I can go into that in detail, but I don't think it's necessary because what I can tell you is that the committee was addressing that concept, which is presented in the context of the antitrust laws. That concept does not carry over to any other body of law. And so we were looking at this concept within the context of antitrust, and that is why it came out as such. I understand the senator's question because, in fact, that requirement is built into consumer protection laws in other states.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please.
You're telling me that other states have a provision that in other contexts other than antitrust that the AG's office will have to give their blessing to a settlement.
Chairman Burdick, Senator Ringo, I know of states that in the consumer protection laws where they are required to provide at least notice, and if I were given a little bit of time, I could probably cite to a couple of state statutes where they would go that far. But at a minimum notice, yes.
Well, that's okay. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Please.
I mean, I'm not opposed to the bill. I think it's fine, but I always understood that it was the province of the court to determine whether the settlement was fair to the aggrieved consumers, the members of the class. And it seems to me now you're adding a second person who has to take a look at it and say that it's fair, and sort of implying that that just having the court look at it wasn't sufficient, that somehow the court reviewing it on behalf of the class members just it wasn't a close enough look to do justice. Is that fair?
It's a fair comment, Chairman Burdick, Senator Ringo. That is a very fair comment because it is possible that it can be seen that way. In fact, this bill does nothing to change the court's authority to finally review and approve the settlement. That still is a requirement. That procedure is still in play. What happens as a practical matter is the courts, just like everyone else these days, are inundated with cases. They have an extremely crowded docket. They are inclined to do the best they possibly can. In fact, they do the best they possibly can in reviewing these settlements. But to give the Attorney General the opportunity to spend, and a staff member who is proficient in this area of law, the opportunity to spend 10, 20, 30, perhaps 40 hours reviewing this settlement would ensure in questionable cases that the nuances of the settlement would be presented to the court for the court's consideration. The court can either accept or reject whatever it is the Attorney General said, but at least the court would have that as a tool in reaching its final decision.
Thank you. One more, Madam Chair. Is there any estimate as to how many lawsuits occur such as this, and therefore how many hours we're going to use of Attorney General's office time on this per year?
Chairman Burdick and Senator Ringo and members of the committee, my recollection is when this bill was presented during the 2003 session, we had presented a fiscal impact statement that said there would be literally no fiscal impact to the Department of Justice. We don't think that there were so many hours that would be involved in the review by an assistant attorney general, and this is something that can be easily built into the responsibilities of that particular staff attorney.
Make them work on Saturdays.
Pardon?
Make them work on Saturdays.
Sundays, I think they're already on Saturdays.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions? Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on the last comment about the bill being before us in 2003, because I remember seeing it before. I was upstairs taking care of some other things, listening, but I didn't hear any explanation or history as to why it's here today, what actually was the demise apparently in 2003.
Well, Senator Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, and chairs and members of the committee, I think we all remember the 2003 legislative session as, in many respects, groundbreaking, and certainly you folks were very, very, very busy. And I think what happened was a number of good ideas just didn't get the attention that they needed because there was so much to go on. I don't know of anyone who or any representative of the community that was opposed to this bill back in 2003.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think that is the best construction of a failed bill that I've ever heard. It's just priceless. I'm going to remember that next time. Thank you, Mr. Albertine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner with the Gardner & Gardner Law and Lobbying Firm, and I am appearing today on behalf of Microsoft in support of the bill. Andy and I kind of put together at Hardy Meyer's direction this work group that worked to develop the concept of the bill in the run-up to last session, and as Andy has mentioned, it was a unanimous product. I would like to briefly respond to one of Senator Ringo's questions, which is why should the AG insert himself or herself into this process since you've got the judge already looking over it? And Andy and Fred are too modest to say it, but there is real value, in my opinion, in having the deep expertise of the Department of Justice with regard to what can sometimes be fairly arcane antitrust issues, having that expertise available almost in an amicus capacity or an intervener capacity to a circuit court judge or a U.S. district court judge that may not be as familiar as folks like these are with the nuances of the antitrust issues.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 215. And, committee, it's my intention to move into a work session on this bill unless I see major heartburn emanating from the podium. I'm assured by counsel that this bill still has no fiscal impact, which means that they are still working on planning to work on Sunday. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 215.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 215 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 215 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections?
No, Madam Chair, only that I'm not going to be held responsible for these people working on Saturdays and Sundays.
I'm glad you cleared up the record, Senator Walker. I would join in that in that comment. Without objection, Senate Bill 215 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer to carry it? Senator Ringo will carry it. Thank you. Okay, next we have a little bill here, Senate Bill 217. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 217, if I may just get my file here for a second, substitutes the term oral and sexual intercourse for the term deviant sexual intercourse in Oregon's criminal code. It comes to you at the request of Hardy Myers, Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force.
Thank you. And we have signed up for this. Two people in favor, Mary Botkin and Tom Castle. Perhaps the two of you would like to. You gave me the wrong bill, Council.
Oh, I'm sorry.
but surely,
I was wondering why Mary was going to be testifying on
but
this.
But surely you must have some opinions on this. Okay, we do have two witnesses. They are not those I just mentioned. It's Ronell Schenkel and Phyllis Barker. So please forgive me and come and tell us your views on this.
Is it 217, Madam Chair?
Yes, it's 217.
Welcome. I'm Senate Bill 217. For the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel, the Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General. Here today on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers, as I did yesterday, please let me offer apologies again today. He is once again attending our Ways and Means budget presentation and so could not be with you. Maybe on the next one.
Well, please relay to the Attorney General that we did not intentionally schedule it this way because we would have loved to hear from him, but we'd love to hear from you too, so...
I will certainly relay that message. Briefly, you have testimony for your files again today. It is actually the same as the testimony yesterday with regard to background on the Sexual Assault Task Force. It is one of the important pieces of business for the Attorney General, and by way of reminder on what I testified earlier, the focus here for the Attorney General is not only the importance of services to victims, which our department does provide, but also law improvement. The bill that you have before you today is not nearly as exciting as the three we brought yesterday. It is much more technical in nature, and I will leave it to Phyllis to give you some information about that.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Barker from the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, and here to speak about 217. And Senate Bill 217 came at the recommendation of the Victims Response Committee of the Sexual Assault Task Force, wanting to bring to the attention of the legislature that the language that is in the sodomy statute, which was put in about a little over 30 years ago, at this point is not clear enough for the purpose and can be even harmful to victims. The term deviant doesn't define anything, whereas the term that we're proposing in oral intercourse is descriptive and does define the statute in a way that's much clearer to both the system and to victims. And victims have reported both confusion with understanding the crimes that they are involved with in the system and some feeling that that there's even more taint involved or unnecessary embarrassment caused by using this language. So this comes from Victims Around the State through the Victims Response Committee. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, if I might add one other thing, I believe you received a second handout from me. Again, we have some additional proposed amendments on this bill. It came to our attention as we were discussing it that there may still be some confusion between the terms oral and anal intercourse as opposed to the definition of sexual intercourse, so we suggest that going throughout and simply defining the difference between those two would be of added benefit to this bill. So we'll leave it to your discretion how you would like to proceed. It is another fairly technical amendment, but an important one nonetheless.
Well, I think it's early in the session. I think we can wait to get it to the point where it's satisfactory to everybody. So we won't move it today, and we'll wait to see your proposed amendments.
Very happy to do that. Thank you.
Are there questions? Senator Beyer, you look perplexed. Okay. There are no questions. Thank you very much. We will now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 217.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will give you the right witness sign up for us this time.
Wait. We have to open the hearing on Senate Bill 218. We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 218. Council, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 218 comes to you from the Department of Justice, and it allows a public servant or public servant's employer to seek an injunction or restraining order against a person engaging in certain types of conduct, obstructing government, assaulting, menacing, disorderly conduct, harassment, telephone harassment.
Thank you. And now it's time for Mary Botkin and Tom Castle to come forward.
May I also bring forward Ms. Linnell Shank?
Please do. She's always welcome in this committee.
Members of the committee, my apologies for not standing up earlier. Something just came to our attention in the room, so I said I would come up and give you a little preview. For the record, Ron L. Shankle, Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General. This bill is coming to you from our department, and I just wanted to mention it has been here before, and as have many of you, so it will not be a totally new topic. Tom and Mary are going to explain to you a little more about the details, but I did just want to mention that we've had some dialogue with the League of Cities in the room today. We want to be very clear, as I'm sure you do, that the language in the statute about the definitions and the terms is accurate, and everyone will understand it after we leave, presuming you pass this bill for us. So we will continue to have that discussion, but I wanted to alert you there may be a need for an amendment. There may not. We're not totally resolved. Our apologies, but we will continue to talk with them and make sure this will be very clear with regard to definitions.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, committee members. My name is Thomas Castle. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I'm appearing here today on behalf or in favor of Senate Bill 218. Senate Bill 218 is designed to protect public employees from persons who engage in criminal conduct that is directed at the public servant. The law permits a court to issue an injunction against an offending person upon a petition, assuming there is evidentiary support for that petition. That presumably would be in the form of an affidavit from the public servant. The person against whom the injunction is directed has the right to a hearing and can have that hearing if it requests one within 30 days. The bill, as has been explained by Rennell, should be amended to perhaps include the language in 1B, which defines a public servant. Speaks to public servant to include persons that are either elected or appointed, and not merely based on their relationship, contractual relationship, or otherwise with a public entity. What this bill is about is the fact that public employees simply don't have a choice about performing their jobs. They have a duty to perform their jobs, and they have to interact with the public whether they want to do that or not. This bill offers them another layer of protection. Additional protection so that they should not be exposed to an unreasonable risk of harm while performing their jobs. I'm
have personally handled several cases, not many, but a few cases, where we've had to go to the courts to seek injunctive relief. It sometimes becomes time-consuming, it can be expensive, and is sometimes contested as well. I handled one case several years ago in Washington County. A child services worker had gone into the home and had removed several children who had been abused from the home. She later spoke with the father of these children. The father verbally threatened her. She went home. She was a single mom. It was the end of her workday. Late in the evening, she heard noises outside her house, some rustling on her door. She went outside, opened up her door about 11 o'clock at night. There was a red swastika spray painted on her door. She was a Jewish worker. She was horrified by this event. She jumped into her car, took her kids with her, drove off in the middle of the night, was driving down the road in Washington County, and as she's driving along, a car with its bright lights on came flying up right alongside of her, scared the daylights out of her. She pulled off, and the car kept on going. She was never able to identify the driver, however, although we certainly assumed that it was the father of these children who she'd taken out of the home that day.
Mr. Castle, Senator Przanski has a question.
This is all like deja vu today. I remember this bill, I think, again last year. Do we have the same explanation as to the last one as to why it's back before us and why it didn't make it through the last time? Because I remember it being voted out on the House side.
I don't think...
It had a constitutional problem in the Senate.
Okay. Just needed to know what it was.
We were busy. We had a busy session. That must have been
it. It was just a constitutional issue. It was no big deal.
We had a busy session, a busy committee, a busy...
There are several other agencies that support this bill. I know that the Department of Environmental Quality as often on a weekly basis has problems at their emission testing sites up in Portland where they're threatened on a regular basis by folks whose cars fail inspection for one reason or another. I believe that the Department of Forestry has also encountered some problems with environmental activists who have gone beyond the scope of the beyond the bounds of the law in terms of their enthusiasm in protecting the environment. That's essentially what I have, unless there are any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Council.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Castle, I've been here when I've had seen legislative chairs followed home. I've seen legislators threatened over bills. Would this bill apply to legislators?
It would, especially if we had the amendments. I think that legislators already are public servants.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the amendment that the League of Oregon Cities has discussed, in fact, would include elected or appointed officials as well.
Thank you.
I think given what we experienced in the Senate this week, I think it's probably a fairly timely bill. Are there other questions, this witness? Ms. Botkin.
I'm sorry to disappoint the committee in the deviant sexual definitions, but...
We
you know, this is going to be a great session, I can tell.
We were hoping you wouldn't bring that up, Ms. Botkin. Please proceed.
For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we represent about 22,000 public employees in Oregon. I can make this very quick. This is a good bill. It needs to be passed. It needs to be passed for a whole bunch of reasons, but probably one of the most obvious reasons is, you know, the stories that the AG told you, but it's also our experience with our members who are trying to do their jobs and are pretty consistently threatened. We've had DEQ employees who are responsible for doing environmental site testing on private property threatened. In fact, one officer or one employee who talked to me after last session literally had his life threatened by a farmer up in Wasco County because he entered the property to do some testing on some water that was there. And, you know, this was not a big deal until it sort of escalated beyond reason. And We have OIA officers who are expected to go into, and I know we're going to all get tired of hearing this, but it is, you know, it's the meth environment, and our officers are expected to go in to a meth environment to remove kids or parolees from a dangerous environment, and I don't think this protects them. I think it just simply adds a layer of protection for them and gives them some very necessary tools whereby they can seek appropriate assistance. So we're supporting this bill. We supported it last time, and I actually think it was here 6 years ago as well. And I was going to introduce the bill, and thank goodness the Department of Justice eliminated that necessity on my part, and I'm thrilled to death to support their bill.
Thank you. Well, I think at this time we will, do committee members have questions? I think we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 218, and we'll give the parties a chance to discuss whether an amendment is necessary, and I look forward to seeing it back before this committee soon. Thank you. We are going to turn now to Senate Bill 251. Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 251 comes to you from the Senate Parental Abduction Task Force, extends the statute of limitations of period of time to which criminal prosecution may be commenced for custodial interference from the current 3 years to 6 years after commission of the custodial interference, or if the victim is under 18 years, whichever event occurs first. Madam Chair, you have Senator Frank Morse here, and he's also here to testify on the other bill from the task force, which is Senate Bill 252.
Great. Welcome to the committee, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. I'm, for the record, Frank Morse, State Senator representing the Lynn and Benton counties. I was asked by Senator Gordley to assist her in co-chairing the committee in the interim on parental abduction, and we had an incredibly talented panel that served with us, representing district attorneys, judges, folks that are professional in this field. And it was really an eye-opener for me because I had no appreciation for the extent of the problem that is created when parents, when they have court orders, in violation of those court orders, when they abduct their children and move to another state, hide them, move to another area. We looked at quite a wide-ranging menu of things, that, and Bill Taylor was very, very helpful in this process, to try to bring some assistance to the aggrieved parent and the potentially injured child in this process of parental abduction. And we settled on these two recommendations that we're bringing forward, House Bill 2152 and 2151 and 2152.
Senator, not as extensive. Forgive me for just a moment. I will.
Excuse me, Senate Bill.
It's Senate Bill 251. I need to open the hearing on both, so I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 251 and 252, so you can just testify on them both at once.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Pardon the interruption.
Not a problem. But we bring these two bills forward as we believe that they are, in fact, helpful. As I said, they're not as aggressive, I guess you might say, as we had hoped for in our committee. But as Mr. Taylor has described, the 251 extends the statute of limitations. We believe that that is a reasonable and helpful extension of the law. 2152 amends the current definition of what is an injury with an Oregon's Victim Compensation Act to include the injury a child incurs when that child is the victim of custodial interference. It is also intended to include this injury within Oregon's Victim Compensation Act so that children who have been abducted by their parent in violation of Oregon's custodial interference statutes, in fact, can be compensated. So, Madam Chair, colleagues, I believe these are reasonable bills. It was an honor for me to serve with Senator Gordley and working on this through the interim, and would encourage your adoption and referral to the floor.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of Senator Morris? Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Senator Morris, just looking at what currently is in the rule, as to, I know we're just adding these to a list of other crimes that would have that new statute of limitations. Did the committee discuss where it talks about, it says the prosecution for any of the following felonies may commence within 6 years of the commission of the crime, and then it says, or if the victim at the time is under age 18, any time before the victim attains the age 24 or 6 years from the offense when it's reported. I'm assuming that all of these custody interference cases would occur when the child is under age 18.
Yes.
Okay. Was there any discussion as to, now it seems to me that we're basically, we're not necessarily going to go under the 6 year rule. It's, it may be more under the 24-year age, unless I guess that person makes the, or well, even if they made the discovery or the made the complaint, there would be 6 years from then under the other component of this. So it's still going to be 24 years, I guess.
I would ask Mr. Taylor to elaborate on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Brzezinski, the testimony we heard and the reason for putting it in this particular section, which is basically the sex offense statutes, are similar in the sense that from what we heard, oftentimes the victim, in this case being the child, may not know about the parental abduction until they're 30. So it would start to run so that you have that same element that you have with a sex offense statute. So in the sense that the victim at many times is either afraid or even unaware of what has happened until after their age of 18. Now, 30 may not be a good example because I think it probably would have run there anyways, but say, for example, that the kid's 20 years old.
So under the scenario, counsel, would that mean that they would have 6 years if they reported at age 20? Because I just want to make sure that we set a record here as to what we are anticipating this is going to provide for. Because when I look at it, it says that the victim is at the time of the crime is under 18, then it's any time before the age 24 or within 6 years after the offense is reported.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, probably the best way for me to answer that would be treated the same way that it's treated now for the crime of listed below, criminal mistreatment in the first degree, rape in the third degree, et cetera.
Okay.
We treat it the exact same way.
So to follow up Senator Brzezinski's question, that would, somebody could be 50 years old before.
No. Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat confusing, but I would assume that before they reach age 24, if they discover or report, I should say not discover, then there'd be 6 years from that.
That's right.
If they don't report by age 24, they're out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Brzezinski, I think the operative phrase in line 12, whichever occurs first.
Right.
Thank you for that clarification. Are there other? Are you done, Senator?
I am. Thank you.
Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Senator Morris. Did you want to make any other comments on Senate Bill 252 while you're there, or do you feel like you've covered it?
I have addressed 252 as well as 251. I would like to make the comment that Senator Gordley would be here today had she not been chairing the committee, Public Safety Committee.
All of our witnesses for today are down in Public Safety Subcommittee.
So I'm filling in for her, helping her, and I think this is good legislation. I think it doesn't do what the committee wanted to do, but it's helpful.
Thank you very much.
So the committee was hoping to do, I guess.
And thank you for your hard work on this.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we will call Sean Cruz and Liz Hart Carrere to the podium, and I regret that I'm going to have to leave for a few minutes, and I understand there is a video attached to this presentation. I would like to request that I be given an opportunity to see that, which I won't be able to see now, but I need to leave for a few minutes, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to my honorable vice chair, Senator Starr.
Yes, introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony on Senate Bill 251.
Do you want to go first?
Yes.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bills 251 and 252. My name is Liz Hart-Haviv. I was a member of the Oregon Senate Task Force on Parental Abduction. I'm the executive director of Take Root, a national support and advocacy organization for former abducted children, funded by the Department of Justice's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Every member of Take Root is, like myself, an adult who was an abducted child. Every one of us was abducted by a parent or a family member. Take Root thanks the state of Oregon for acknowledging abduction by family members as a significant community concern, and I was personally pleased and honored to serve the Oregon Senate Task Force on Parental Abduction. What I'm going to do today is briefly cover why it is so important that abduction by family members remain a focus of the Oregon Senate, talk about the significance of the bills currently before you, and leave you with some ideas about what we can accomplish in the future. Now, first, let me address the scope of the problem. We know from national incident studies conducted by the Department of Justice that over 200,000 children are abducted by family members every year. Family abduction accounts for 78% of all child abduction in America. Now, we don't know the statistics for Oregon, and that is one of the problems that your task force addressed and can rectify. But we do know that the national incidence rate is alarmingly high. We do know that families in Oregon are being impacted. Now, bear in mind that ascertaining the number of children who are taken from Oregon and or the number of recoveries that are made in Oregon can only give us one part of the equation. There's simply no way to track how many abducted children are taken to Oregon. Abduction is about going into hiding. There's no doubt that abductors and abducted children remain uncounted here in the shadows. We're close to the Canadian border. We have moderate homeschooling regulations as opposed to highly regulated homeschooling in other states, and that's according to the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. We have a general cluster and culture of laws that and attitudes that kind of facilitate hiding out. So not only do we need to improve services and information and legal remedy available to Oregon parents whose children have been abducted, we must also raise community awareness of family abduction so that it is harder for those seeking refuge here to hide. With millions of American families being impacted nationwide, family abduction is an issue that deserves to be on the table in our community, in every community. And it's important to set the tone by making family abduction a legislative focus. Now, however, we must not only raise issue awareness and improve the services and information available to parents whose children have been abducted, we must also begin to provide appropriate services and information to the primary victim, to the abducted child. At the nation's leading missing child organizations, organizations like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the Polly Klass Foundation, our state clearinghouses, who is the primary victim? With whom do case managers work? Who's the actual recipient of direct services? When the parent becomes the primary client, the parent also becomes perceived as the primary victim. Now, similarly, media coverage typically tells us the searching parent's stories and experience. And who do you suppose provides the primary data that missing child researchers and policy analysts work with? One problem with this lack of focus on the child as the primary victim in a family abduction is that it encourages a myth that often goes along with family abduction. The myth is that even though we can empathize with the anguish suffered by parents whose children have been taken, parents such as Sean Cruz, who we'll hear from in just a moment, we somehow often think that the kids are ultimately okay because, after all, they're with a parent. Family abduction simply does not raise the alarm bells that it should. Now, when you start to hear from the children of abduction, as we do at Take Root, it becomes crystal clear that the fact that we are taken by a family member does not make it a benign form of abduction. There is no benign form of abduction. Whether we're taken by a family member or taken by a stranger, being abducted is a crime against a child. Parentally abducted children speak of being taken into hiding, of being forced to change schools every few months, of being kept out of school altogether, of being denied medical treatment, of being locked in the house. Some speak of being beaten and raped, yes, by their parent. Abduction is the act of a desperate person. Whatever the abductor's rope is, they've reached the end of it. They are checking out beyond reach of any authority, and they're taking us with them. Now, not all abducted children suffer the kind of abuse that leaves visible scars. In fact, for most of our members at Take Root, the damage that crippled them for life is the invisible kind. It's the kind of that scars the heart and the soul and the psyche. To help everybody understand what it means to be abducted, would everybody please look at the doors to this hearing room? And as you look at those doors, think of them as a barrier between you and everything in your life that's not here in this room. And imagine if we told you that you can never see anything in your life on the other side of those doors again. Not only that, you can't even talk about it. We're going to erase everything in your life outside of this room as if it never existed. And like entering the witness protection program, we may give you a new name. We're going to assign you a new birth date, a new place of birth. We're going to give you a whole new identity from this moment forward. And this idea of a door closing between you and your past, between you and everything you love, between you and your very identity, this is a door that every abducted child walks through. However, parental abduction is typically prosecuted, when prosecuted at all, as custodial interference. Custodial interference, meaning a parent's rights to physical custody of their child have been violated. That doesn't sound anything at all like what it means to be abducted. Like the aforementioned service focus and media reporting focus and data collection focus, this is a factor that conspires to make the left-behind parent the perceived primary victim, often to the detriment of the victimized child. Now, I'm telling you all this today for two reasons. The first is to point out something of subtle added significance in the two bills before you. They are a first step in the very important process of restoring focus to the child as the primary victim in a family abduction by extending the statute of limitations to be in line with child sexual abuse and other forms of child abuse, and by clearly defining the child as a compensable victim in victims' compensation statutes. We place violation of the child's rights back at the center of the issue of family abduction. It's a very good first step. Now, the second reason for discussing at length the impact of family abduction on children has to do with an additional result of your task force's work. The Oregon Commission on Children and Families is now developing mechanisms to create a trained multidisciplinary response force in Oregon. Advancement of this effort will truly be revolutionary and be a model for other states to follow. California is currently the only state in the nation taking an aggressive, progressive stance towards the recovery of abducted children. In the final report of the Families of Missing Children Project, commissioned by the Department of Justice, Dr. Chris Hatcher writes, quote, "For the mental health professional who is contacted by a family at recovery, there is no professional literature available to help them assist the recovered child," end quote. Now, it's not just mental health professionals who are in the dark. There exists a clear gap in response services across disciplines when it comes to the missing child problem in America. As a nation, we invest in preventing abduction. We invest even more in locating abducted children, but we have made very little investment in recovery, in developing the ways and means to bring these children home when we find them. We need to be able to do more than locate missing children, more than recover missing children. We need to be equipped to help abducted children recover. The members of Take Root will tell you recovery is ultimately a process, not the event of finding us, but it's this event that starts the process off, on the right foot or on the wrong foot. Currently, and this is again data from the Families of Missing Children Project, 90% of the families recovering missing children receive no mental health or social services support. 66% of reunifications between abducted children and searching family take place on the fly, at a bus stop, at an airport, at the school or the home the child is being removed from. 83% of reunification meetings are 30 minutes or less. 50% are 15 minutes or less. There are rarely established goals or a follow-up care plan. 70% of law enforcement agencies nationwide have no written protocol for responding to family abduction. At Take Root, we call the prevailing recovery model the hug and go. A poorly handled recovery can become a reabduction to the child. Consider one case where the child had been told that the parent they were taken from years earlier and were now being turned over to was the Green River serial killer. Or one of our members who was 12 years old when she was called in the principal's office one day to learn that her name was not Heather. From now on, she would be called Rebecca. She would not be going home. Her mom had just been arrested, and she was being sent to live with family she thought had abandoned her when she was two. None of us are ever told that we've been abducted. We're given some reason to explain the abduction as something else. We're told that the other parent is dead, dangerous, or disinterested. So recovery, an event that is celebrated by searching parents and law enforcement and caseworkers and communities, to the abducted child, it can be a day of grief, shock, rage, confusion, or trauma. Recovery, when poorly handled, can actually exacerbate the trauma for the child. This is something that has rarely been considered, and again, because of a focus on the searching parent as the primary victim and the desire to restore their custody rights being the primary goal. We rarely stop to consider the child's rights and needs independently from those of the searching parent. Being abducted is a very different experience than searching for a missing child, and these two victim populations have a different set of recovery needs. So your task force had the opportunity to examine recovery from the child's perspective and concluded that a strong need exists for trained, informed, qualified respondents. The indomitable Mickey Lansing from the Oregon Commission on Children and Families picked up the charge. And if Mickey has her way, Oregon will soon join California in making truly groundbreaking responses to family abduction available for other states to model. Meanwhile, the two bills before you today both address a practical need and take a step towards restoring focus to the needs and experience of the primary child victim. Developing statewide response capability and bringing the issue of family abduction before the community will take time and effort, but the current proposed legislation represents a productive first step.
Question? Thank you very much. Sean?
Do you want to show the video?
We should probably show the video.
We do have a video available, interviews of with former abducted children who are members of Take Root.
You think it's necessary?
Would the committee like to hear that? See that?
Okay. Let's see it.
All right. Thank you.
When I was 7 years old, 4 years old, I was 9, my brother was 6, and I was in 3rd grade. I was 9 years old, I was 8, I think I was about 6 years old. My biological father, my mother, my dad, my mother.
My father.
My father.
My mother.
My mother.
My father.
My father took me up one weekend and gave me that. I first heard the term parental abduction in August of 2001, and I had never heard the term before. I caught the tail end of a radio program, so I didn't hear the explanation of what it meant. I had a few suspicions that I knew. I went home, and I typed it into a search engine. And I honestly was expecting to get no matches found. There was something like 30,000 hits.
I was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, an American mom, an Argentine dad. I had polio when I was 3 years old, but otherwise had a very normal routine childhood until I was 6 years old.
When I was 7 years old, my mother was in a very horrible car accident. And she couldn't take care of us. She could barely walk. She chose to send me and my sister to other family members. She sent me to my father, my sister, and my uncle. And my mom was supposed to be gone for 3 weeks. My sister came back after 3 weeks, but I didn't.
We went for a normal weekend visitation with our father, but instead of coming back home after the weekend, we just kept driving.
I was abducted at 4 years old, and the only childhood I lived in was Heather Ann Brown. That's who I grew up as with my mother. So I stepped out of the college ball.
There's an underestimation in society of the lasting results and implications of children being abducted by their parents
because they're with a parent. With a parent.
With a parent. They're with a parent.
If a child is with a parent.
That's not kidnapping. How bad can it be? They're not being traumatized. It can't be that bad.
It can't be that bad.
They're okay. And that's just simply not the truth.
Somewhere along the way, my own father told us that my mother had died.
My father had said that my mother didn't want me. Your mother doesn't want you anymore. She gave you to me. And we're going to move to Canada the start of your life.
She told me that my father and my grandparents, who I really adored, had all been killed in a horrible traffic accident, and she pretended to be terribly upset about it, and said that because of that, there was really nothing to go home to.
It was a lie for him, but for me, he's my father, so that's the reality.
There's this dependence that happens when you're abducted by a parent. You're suddenly taken from having a number of people in your life who you're familiar with, aunts, uncles, grandparents, the other parents possibly, school friends, teachers, to having only one person to depend on.
I had access to all the family members. I never stayed in school long enough to make friends. I never got to know neighbors. It was a life of hiding.
Well, you're trying to make a boy, so I wasn't very happy. You made me dress and act like a boy. I was not allowed to play outside. I was not allowed to be my own child.
It was very unnatural. I was the center of his world, and he was the center of mine. I mean, I couldn't depend on him. But it was almost a role reversal, that I wasn't just a child. You know, your mother and your father are supposed to depend on them, and, you know, they're not supposed to lie to you. And she was my whole life, my whole world, and her reality became mine. Everything changed, just in the night and day. Just losing identity, losing everything I've known, school, friends, location, and not knowing who to trust to get in each new location where we're going. I had no connection to other people. I looked at other ghosts.
We were with my father for about 10 months. Meanwhile, my mom is back home in agony, having no idea where we are, not having any sign or hearing from us in any way. And she just worked all she could to try and find us. She tried to work with the authorities, legal authorities, things like that, but didn't get a lot of support there. It was in the 60s, and it's kind of viewed as boys are with their dad.
My mother worked very, very hard to try and find me, and the
police would not help her. No one would help her.
She ended up, along with my family, sending flyers out to nearly every school in the United States. Eventually, fortunately, one of those flyers was recognized in the principal's office in the school where my brother and I were enrolled.
FBI came to my school and took me to class and sat me down, and there was a counselor there, two policemen, two FBI agents, and they showed me a note card and said, "Do you know who this girl is?" And I said, "No," and it was a picture of me and Rebecca.
Finally, she walked into my school room one of the 3 days that I was forced to go to school, and asked me if I wanted to go home with her, and I said yes.
But I knew that from the moment I left to go to college, I was going to be financially independent and emotionally independent. So at that point, I had nothing to lose.
I was never really found. I finally got old enough and matured enough and understood that there were choices, and contacted my brother and my mother when I was 18.
And I just said to my mom, "I'm going to go see my dad."
He dropped us off, and his girlfriend and her son were still in the car. And I still remember the song that was playing on the radio at the time. It was "If You Leave Me Now," I think it's by Chicago. And it was just, it was heart-wrenching because all of a sudden, he's crying, he's sad, and it's my fault. It's my fault that I ruined this for him. We found out somehow, and now he's sad, and now I'm leaving him.
One thing that happens with reunification is that the emphasis so far in society has been on returning an abducted child to the left-behind parents, and there hasn't been much emphasis on what happens after that.
From a child's perspective, it's almost as if it's a reabduction. We've been taken away again from another parent, and with the expectation that now we're safe, now everything's going to be okay. I like to say, a return to normal, you know, for them, and it's anything but.
I didn't trust anyone when I did that. I didn't have a school life. I tried to parent when I should have been a child, and I was so used to being the responsible party in the family.
I have serious trust issues. I have, it's hard to form relationships sometimes to even, you know, I find myself, what do they want from me? I mean, are they going to just walk away when I tell them, you know, what's happened to me or who I really am?
It's difficult to trust people, difficult to open yourself up, difficult to let people see who you really are.
When you have been fed lies by your parents, like your mother is dead, your father doesn't want you, and you believe those lies, it's difficult to trust yourself.
You grow up as a gradually affected child with this incredible sense of isolation, with the sense that you're the kid with their nose up against the outside window of the candy store and looking in at everyone else's family.
There was a need for peer support. There was a need for a network of people who had been through this experience to be able to come together, share our stories, and support one another.
There are 200 standard abductions here.
As opposed to 200,000 parental abductions.
200,000.
200,000.
200,000 children a year. 200,000 parents a year.
200,000.
You know, I didn't think that there was that many of us out there to even have an organization.
It takes great help for adults who were parentally abducted as children to reconnect with a sense of trust and safety, to tell their story, to get support, to work through things, to see common themes,
to be in a room with other people who had gone through my experience as a child, who had been parentally abducted as a child. Just amazing. It's just life changing to know that we're not alone.
All of a sudden, being able to talk to and touch and look in the eyes of people, and that recognition of, oh my God, this happened to you when your parent did the same thing and you had that same visceral reaction, is incredibly affirming.
Quaker is an amazing organization that works very, very hard to change the stigma and change the myth of parental abduction.
It's about, you know, the legal system. It's educating judges, family court judges, law enforcement, and the public at large about how traumatic this is and what it means And, you know, maybe by accident, can we get with your parents who are concerned?
Because I remain convinced that there are always better ways and less hurtful ways to resolve issues than to rip a child out of the world that they know.
Chairman Starr, might I add something? That's pretty much the end. I just wanted to comment about the discussion that came up earlier about the statute of limitations and when it runs. As I noted, you know, we're never told that we've been abducted. We're always given something that explains it as something else. We're told that the other parent has died. We're told that they're dangerous, so they're going to hurt us, they were abusing us, they're an incompetent parent, or we're told that they're not interested, that they walked out on us, abandoned us. So the child, it can take a period of time for the child to understand what happened to them, and that it was an abduction, and that's why extending the statute of limitations on this is so important. It's very similar to child victims of sexual abuse, that they don't perceive themselves as victims, don't process and have the maturity to understand what happened until later in life. And actually, at Take Root, we don't have many members who are in their early 20s. Most of our members are 30s and older, because it really takes a while to process what happened to you.
Thank you. Any further questions? No questions.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cruz. I testified before this committee in the 03 session regarding a bill creating a task force to study the issue of parental and family abductions, and I'm very grateful that this committee voted to move that bill and that Senate President Peter Courtney appointed a stellar task force co-chaired by Senators Abel Gordley and Frank Morse. Before I speak to the issue of statute of limitations today, I'd like to provide you with some background information. I'm the father of four children who were abducted from the state of Oregon 9 years ago in violation of a joint custody order by a group of people that included my former wife. I want to state right at the outset that I've forgiven my children's mother for her part in this. I want to be clear about that. Nothing can bring back the past, the lost 9 years. More than anything, what I want is to reassemble my family and restore our relationships and move on. I have forgiven her for what she's done. On the other hand, the estrangement and the harm of the abduction continues. I have not seen so much as a school picture of any of my children in 9 years. I have a son, now 21 years old, who is serving in Iraq with the National Guard. I saw him once for a single hour when he was 16. It's the last time I saw a photograph of him. I expect that I will spend the rest of my life trying to recover relationships with my children, and I expect that the damage done to their lives by the abduction will continue throughout theirs. There is no escaping the damage. Before my children disappeared, I had never heard of such a thing as a family of parental abductions. Afterwards, I encountered many people who were aware and who helped me understand that these abductions occur far too often. According to DHS, the state of Oregon doesn't track these things in any way, but DHS's best estimate was 5,000 Oregon children a year are victims. Unfortunately, with a single exception, none of the people I met who understood the issue were lawyers or judges or officers of the court. As I relate my experience as the victim of a kidnapping, I'd like you to keep in mind that my story is illustrative of the stories of many more people. We all receive these postcards in the mail from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and most of them identify a child that has been missing for years. For many, the photo has been age-enhanced. The only person who really knows what that child looks like today is the abducting parent. I've seen some cases that are more than 20 years old. That child may be in his or her 30s or 40s now, but because that postcard arrived in the mail today, you can be sure that somewhere a parent is still looking for his or her child and not getting any help from law enforcement or anyone else. Now, this one happened to come in the mail yesterday, and it's pictures a child who was abducted from Longview, Washington at the age of one in 2001, and they have a picture here of what they think he might look like now that he's 4 years old. And what my experience and the information we developed in the task force is that to know that nobody's helping this family be reunited. This is why the statute of limitations is such an important issue and why your work on this is so vital. ORS statutes recognize two degrees of criminality in parental or family abductions, and I'd like to read for the record the two applicable statutes which may be found in the chapter on kidnapping. ORS 163.245, custodial interference in the second degree. A person commits the crime of custodial interference in the second degree if, knowing or having reason to know that the person has no legal right to do so, the person takes, entices, or keeps another person from the other person's lawful custodian or in violation of a valid joint custody order with intent to hold the other person permanently or for a protracted period. Custodial interference in the second degree is a Class C felony. ORS 163.257, custodial interference in the first degree, states a person commits the crime of custodial interference in the first degree if the person violates the previous statute and A, causes the person taken, enticed, or kept from the lawful custodian or in violation of a valid joint custody order to be removed from the state, or B, exposes that person to a substantial risk of illness or physical injury. Custodial interference in the first degree is a Class B felony. The Interim Task Force on Parental and Family Abductions concluded that any abduction, even if short-term, exposes the victims to a substantial risk of illness or injury. And so does the testimony of Ms. Hart-Aviv. I would ask this committee to consider changes to statute and state policy to reflect that fact. I had been a joint custodial parent for 5 years at the time of the abduction. The custody order spelled out the days and times that my children would reside with each parent and specified that all major decisions, including educational, would be made by both parents together. It worked out that I saw my children an average of 180 days a year and was their Little League coach for 8 years. I also had a long-standing habit of taking my children to work with me at every opportunity. We had a rotation system in my family, and once a child was about 4 years old, he or she was in the rotation. The last time I took a child to work with me was the Saturday before the abduction. When my former wife remarried in 1995 and moved to Hillsboro from Battleground, Washington, I also moved from my home in Vancouver to Aloha to be closer to my children. I also brought my mother to Oregon with me. She had come for a 2-week visit but had become ill and unable to travel. Her illnesses made her housebound, and I became her sole caregiver. She knew no one in Oregon except for her 4 grandchildren, and the 6 of us made up a 3-generational household. It was 9 years ago today, on February 2nd, 1996, that I received a phone call from my son's counselor in the Hillsboro School District advising me that my former wife had abruptly taken her 4 children out of school. It was also my little girl's 8th birthday. I haven't celebrated a birthday or any kind of holiday since that day. My mother died 6 years later without ever seeing her grandchildren again, and they have never seen her grave. You may recall the big storm that hit the Northwest in February 1996, at a time when there was widespread flooding, and I-84 in the Gorge and I-5 at Tacoma were both closed. My children were somewhere out in those roads, as their abductors had a schedule to keep. It is important to recognize that the crimes of first and second degree custodial interference do not apply only to abducting parents or family members. The statute reads, a person commits the crime. Some states have a statute that limits to family members, but we don't. My children were protected by ORS statutes at the time of the abduction. The abduction of my children was the work of as many as 10 persons in 3 states who shared in common certain religious beliefs and goals, and they decided that they wanted my children to be raised full-time in their particular religious system. They were aware that the joint custody order was a barrier, so they developed a plan in secret over a period of several months and executed it 9 years ago today. They used their positions of influence in my children's lives through their church, their school, and their family connections to commit what became a series of crimes for which the statute of limitations has long barred prosecution. One person, for example,
one of the highest-ranking leaders in their church in the Hillsborough area, took a sudden interest in giving my child a ride to school every morning in the weeks before the abduction. She provided logistical support, coerced my children to keep quiet, and was the recipient of all of the desperate letters I wrote to my children after they disappeared. And all I had was the last address, and I'd write "please forward" on the letters, and they were all forwarded to this person's address in Hillsborough rather than to wherever my children were taken. I understand that's not a crime. Two or more other persons arranged for housing and employment in a rural area in the mountains east of Ogden, Utah, and there were others in Oregon and Washington who played roles in the abduction plan, including two church bishops and other officials. Another person, who became my children's second stepfather, later repeatedly assaulted two of my children and their mother and at least one of their friends, according to affidavits entered in the subsequent divorce. At least some of these incidents occurred in the presence of my younger children, which is an additional aggravated felony, but the police and the courts never addressed those concerns either. All of these people got get-out-of-jail-free cards when the statute of limitations told on their crimes. The essential point I want to make is that it makes no sense for an abduction statute to toll when the child has not been recovered, but that is the case today. And with every day that passes, the statute tolls for someone's child. An abduction is a continuing crime. A child is just as abducted on the last day as he or she was on the first day, perhaps, given the emotional harm that occurs in all cases, even more so. I received the news that they had taken my children out of school on a Friday afternoon. I started working on getting a restraining order to prevent them from taking my children out of state the following Monday, but it was already too late. By the time the order was issued, they had disappeared. I contacted the sheriff's office to report the abduction, and a deputy came out to verify the joint custody order and fill out a police report, but there was never any investigation. When we finally got into court, the judge wouldn't allow my attorney to raise the issue as an abduction. She told him, "I don't want to hear about an abduction." She said she didn't want to hear about it. I was in Judge Johnson's court for the next 2.5 years without ever being allowed to speak while the statute of limitations continued to run. Having had that experience, Chair Starr, members of the committee, I am all the more grateful that you are willing to allow me to speak today. My attempts to recover my children and get my joint custody order enforced would eventually involve retaining 5 lawyers in 4 jurisdictions in 3 states. My children's abductors would eventually hire a dozen lawyers to maintain the abduction status quo, which is all they really had to do. At no point did any court respect the fact that time and contact with the children was the most important factor, nor did the judges involved ever address the fact that criminal statutes had been violated. They wanted to package this as some kind of a domestic dispute between 2 ex-spouses. They allowed time and our lives to drain away. The abduction itself is the only thing that happens with any speed, with any regard to time. The courts don't care. You can always count on a lawyer to find a way to buy time. If not, a kidnapper can always fire his lawyer at the last minute and buy more time. And every day that passes is another successful day for a kidnapper. I also learned that every time you go to court to try to get an order to see your child, the abductors who continue to hold your child will not hesitate to put your child through hell to maintain the abduction. They will force your child to choose a parent, and they will bring that choice to the courtroom. This is pure child abuse. There came a point several years after the abduction began where I walked out of a courtroom in Utah, empty-handed once again, seeing once again that my children's abductors were hiding their own criminal conduct behind my children, that the story of Solomon and the 2 women who both claimed to be the mother of the same child came to my mind. Solomon offered to settle the matter by dividing the child with a sword. The thief was willing to see the child harmed. The real mother would allow the thief to take the child rather than see the child divided. I resolved on that day not to see my children divided by an unfeeling, uncaring court again, and I abandoned any further attempt to obtain an order for the return of my children. It was better to allow the thieves to keep the children, given no other choice. Several months after the abduction, the Washington County DA's office contacted me. Assistant DA Jim Fun was the one person in the system in all these years that I ever encountered who understood the law. Mr. Fun told me that he was ready to take the case to the grand jury, but first he wanted me to take a couple of days to think about whether I wanted to proceed with the criminal charges. I took a month. I couldn't have been more reluctant. I never wanted to see my children's mother charged with a crime. But at the same time, I was thinking this over in the other courtroom. The judge wouldn't even allow me to speak, wouldn't allow the subject of what was happening be discussed. All I wanted was the return of my children. I didn't want to see my ex-wife put in jail. After a month went by and there was no change in the nightmare, I called Mr. Fun and said I would proceed if there was a guarantee that my children's mother would do no jail time. He promised that the DA would ask the judge for counseling and no time in custody. On that basis, I went forward. I testified before the grand jury, an indictment was issued, and the nightmare continued. 2 weeks after the kids disappeared, I was fired from my job. My employer said I didn't have my mind on my work. When I explained my kids were missing, he said, "Well, aren't they with their mother?" And I said, "I think so. She's missing too." And he said, "Well, don't worry. Things will be all right." I was fired 5 times in all during 1996 while I was simultaneously caring for my mom and attempting to locate and recover my children who were in another state somewhere. Subsequent to the abduction, I fell into a major clinical depression, lost the ability to care for my mom, lived in my car. The depression was so severe it took away my ability to read. I became suicidal. I've known hunger and homelessness and hopelessness. On New Year's Eve at the end of 1996, during another major storm, not knowing when or if I would ever see my children again, the river was at flood stage. I was standing on the banks of the Willamette at Oaks Park in Portland preparing to walk into the river when a stranger intervened, and I went to get some help. The Oregon Health Plan and the mental health services provided to me by OHSU over the next year or so saved my life. A few weeks after the incident at the river, I met the pastor of Victory Outreach Church in Northeast Portland. Pastor Max Garza offered me a bunk bed in the church's men's reentry home, and for the next 5 years, I lived there with men in recovery from drug addiction and other problems while I worked to rebuild my life through volunteerism. As the son of a police officer, I was naturally drawn to law enforcement issues. I've been a volunteer member of the Portland Police Bureau's Hispanic Crisis Response Team, working with the families of homicide victims for 7 years. I was a Weed and Steed Steering Committee member in North Northeast Portland for more than 5 years, working on anti-crime issues. I became a founding board member of the national organization of Weed and Seed in Washington, D.C., and served a term representing the Pacific Northwest region while living in a men's reentry home. I served as Senator Gordy's legislative aide in the 2003 session and during the interim, and I was recently appointed to the Chief's Forum, a key policy advisory post by Portland Police Chief Derek Foxworth. On the other hand, I continue to suffer from insomnia, frequent nightmares in which I'm searching for a child, and depression. I feel my pain and the pain of my children in a way that only a parent can understand. I have a child whose voice I have not heard in 8 years, and I know she's hurting. I have a child who has now been fatherless for more than half her life and counting. Today is her 17th birthday. My children are now on their third stepdad. I understand he's a good, decent man, but I really don't know who's raising my child. Chair Starr, members of the committee, I'm not happy to be here today to talk about what happened to my family. Frankly, I never know if anything I do or say will help me recover my children or make things worse. I have no idea. But I made a commitment a long time ago to try to help other families recover from abduction and to work to prevent abductions from occurring and to tell the truth about what happened. And that's why I'm here today. It is vitally important that the people we count on to enforce our laws understand what those laws are and why they are on the books. The DA's office made a decision to charge only my former wife with custodial interference and give the others get-out-of-jail-free cards. When the case finally came up for trial, my joint custody order had been in continuous violation for nearly a year and a half. The trial began even though there had never been any investigation. I was never contacted by a detective. The defense witnesses were the very people who had abducted my children. although the jury never heard that. And some members of the jury were also members of the same church congregations that the abductors belonged to. My former wife testified at trial that it was all a misunderstanding, that I was perfectly welcome to see the children, that it was important that the children and I maintain our relationships, and so on. So even though my children were still taken, enticed, and held, somewhere in Utah, as the jury deliberated, the verdict returned was not guilty. Several years later, I received a letter from Mr. Steve Nielsen, my children's second stepdad. He was apparently feeling some degree of remorse. He apologized for committing perjury in the trial and also revealed that they had contacted some jurors' families outside the courtroom through their church organization to influence the outcome of the trial. He also admitted to slapping my kids around for disciplinary reasons. I passed this information on to the DA's office, but they never went anywhere with it, and Mr. Nielsen has never been charged with a crime. Forcing my former wife to stand alone in a criminal docket while all of the other people who kept, enticed, and held my children in violation of the same statutes was wrong. It was a serious failure of the state to enforce its own laws and implement its own policies, and it added to the harm done to my children. The state bears a responsibility for this harm, as do the officers of the court, the lawyers and judges who should have known the law and who should have had some minimal sense of the pain and suffering the victims of these crimes endure. And in closing, I want to say that the most important thing is the speedy return of the children and the prevention of the abduction in the first place. As this committee deliberates this bill and other bills related to child abduction and work goes forward to develop a comprehensive solution to the problem, I ask that you picture yourselves and your families in this situation. Ask yourself these questions. How soon would you want your child returned to you? If 6 months go by, time measured in sleepless nights and constant fear and worry, 6 months and counting, that you do not know where your child is living, how high a priority should this be for law enforcement and for the justice system? Can you imagine living like that for 6 months, missing one child, missing four children? You can be certain, as the abduction continues, that nights and weekends are free times for the abductors of your child. Everyone goes home after five, and no one is helping you recover your child. You are on your own. Do you think that accomplices to the abduction of your child should bear no liability for their crimes? Should the statute of limitations clock start running before your child is returned or after? Should the statutes run while you do everything you know how to do, but law enforcement and the courts may or may not do anything at all, and in every case, at every interminable moment, treat the abduction of your child as if time had no value? How can there be justice? Supposing your child is recovered, were other crimes committed against your child during the abduction? How are you supposed to find out? You're not going to want to grill your child, and you will want to protect your child from any additional harm, including lots of questions from strangers. It may be years later that you learn of other abuse and or other crimes committed against your child. Studies show that the children suffer every other sort of abuse during an abduction, sexual, physical, and emotional, and they suffer the abuse of the abduction itself, which does long-lasting harm to the child. Should persons who committed criminal acts against your child escape the administration of justice for the reason that the child was unable to report the crime within the statutory time? How do we as a state deliver justice to these children and these families? Should statutes on other crimes committed in the course of an abduction bar prosecution and the administration of justice for the abductors of your child? Shouldn't the whole of the criminal conduct be taken together after the child is returned? These are important questions. And here's another. Child support. An abduction will really set you back. The initial shock of the crime and then the daily emotional drain on top of everything else you have to go through. I'm still deep in debt to lawyers who didn't understand the law and therefore were of no practical help. And I wonder if they even cover this in law school. Because I don't think so. I think the system dysfunction is that deep. It took me 7 years to get current in child support. I've paid more than $50,000 in child support since the initial violation of my family's joint custody order. I'm current in child support today and have been every day of the past 2 years. I believe children must be supported financially, but they must be supported emotionally as well. State policy needs to be as firm on the emotional side as it is on the financial side. People commit crimes for many different reasons. In 1995 and 1996, several persons living in three states made a conscious decision to commit four Class B and four Class C felonies against me, against my children, and against the people of the state of Oregon, because they felt the religion gave them a certain moral superiority, even an entitlement to break the law. Committing those crimes of custodial interference opened the door to the commission of subsequent crimes. These bills are important steps in developing a comprehensive state policy to deal with child abduction crimes. Later in the session, we'll be back before this committee with a bill to address the issue of civil liability for the crime of child abduction and to continue work on establishing a state policy. If your child vanished in an abduction, would you want state policy to ensure that your child has a quality education and access to college? Or would you be satisfied in relying on the goodwill of the people who took your child away from you, from your home, and their home, from their friends, from your family, from the heritage of your family, from the cultural identity of your family, from the school you enrolled them in, from the neighborhood and the community that you were raising them in? Would you want to rely on their goodwill? And what about health issues? How are the victims going to be made whole, and who is going to pay for it? If the law was clear on this point, the prospect of financial liability might deter some people from committing these crimes. Midway through the second summer after the abduction, I stood in a courtroom trying to get an order for visitation and listen to the lawyers and the judge schedule another hearing for argument as to under what circumstances my children and I might be briefly united for a visit. They were having difficulty coming up with a date because of conflicts in their respective vacations. So they put the case on hold so they could enjoy their vacations, and thus the summer waned and the opportunity ran out. Shame on them all. The statute of limitations continued to run. I have no idea what my children's summer was like, just mine alone. Mine was a living hell, every day of it. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I apologize for the length of my testimony. I'm very grateful for this time. The Task Force on Parental and Family Abductions concluded that much effort needs to be expended on educating legislators and the public on the scope of the problem, and I'm here to put a human face on it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will move to, just for those in the audience, if we don't get through all of our witnesses today, we will continue the hearing at a later time. But for now, we'll go to Renell Schenkel and Mickey Lansing. Still here.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Ronell Schenkel, Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General. Chair Burdick, by point of clarification, are we still in public hearing on both bills?
We are in public hearing on both bills, so feel free to comment on one, both, or...
I will do so. Just wanted to clarify, and I will be very brief. The Attorney General was not able to be here, but he wanted me to come and relay his support of both of these Senate bills before you today. Our department was very honored to be appointed to this task force. It's an important issue for the department, both in that it involves family law issues and potential law improvement, which is important to the Attorney General, and it touches on several areas of services from within our department. The only thing that I would offer in addition to the Attorney General's support is that there are some amendments. I apologize. I'll give them to Dale. Senator Gordley asked the department while we were serving on the task force and this bill was in draft stage to look more clearly at our crime victims assistance program and compensation specifically and ensure that the language would be clear. I don't think we're quite there with regard to Senate Bill 252, so we have provided some additional language by way of two amendments that would make the statute more clear in that area.
Thank you. Thank you. Did you have amendments to Senate Bill 251 as well?
Chair Burdick, we do not have any proposed amendments, no.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And I must acknowledge Liz Hart Haviv's remarks were very kind in many ways, but we are all doing something in just a very small way. So we're not yet to where we would like to go. But I quickly want to tell you that I, too, share Senator Morris's feelings about being on the Parental and Family Abduction Task Force. It was both an honor and a privilege. Little did I know the extent, both the breadth and the depth, of the issue around parental and family abduction. As we went through the process and we heard parents, we heard children, we heard family members in terms of the effects of this particular issue, it was both heart-wrenching and discouraging to see that the resources available to us were very few. We found out that both the law community or the legal community and law enforcement had much confusion and a lack of understanding about what was really on the books of the law, how far their particular jurisdiction extended, and what it is they needed to do. We also tried to look at the community to see what kind of resources were available to both parents and children regarding this issue, and found that we had very little resource and very little was known about this. I, in fact, called our state boards of clinical social workers, psychologists, to see if, in fact, they had anyone that they knew of within their particular community that had any kind of expertise or specialization in this particular issue. I even went and visited with the state board of social workers, and I almost felt like a deer in headlights, in that we had to explain to them quite thoroughly exactly what it is we were talking about. However, they were very responsive to the issue and said they would like to know more. So as we looked at it, there were two main concerns that we felt we could start to address, and that's that we could bring the law enforcement and legal community together to get a lot more education on what already is on the books, and that we could also use other resources, especially the resources that Liz Hart Haviv and Take Root has developed in the state of Washington, to come to Oregon and help train professionals in our state around this particular issue. So the Oregon Commission on Children and Families is working with Willamette University. We're going to have an intern come to our office. Our hope is by the end of the year that we can help to support a symposium where we can start to bring the professionals together so they can start having the dialogue on what is it really that we can do here in the state of Oregon to support kids and their families who are victims of parental and family abduction. We support Senate Bill 251 and 252.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Ringo?
Thank you, and I guess first to Sean, I mean, what a gut-wrenching story, and I think it took a lot of courage on your part to come out and testify to that, and I just think how this has impacted you and, you know, how I would feel about my two little boys, and I don't know how you deal with it. And these heart-wrenching stories they're very hard to deal with. And one of the things I've wondered ever since I've become a member of the legislature is how to respond to reactions that sometimes it's, well, let's increase the penalty, or let's crack down in some other way that is almost more of an emotional, therefore it'll solve the problem, than really considered this is something that will address the problem. And it's so tempting to do things like that. And I apologize because I missed a lot of the earlier testimony, and I don't know anything about the task force other than what I just heard. But I wanted to ask a couple questions, and I kind of just wanted to give you that context. The two crimes are at issue, the custodial interference in the second degree and first degree. If you've got a situation where let's say there's a custody order, so just as a hypothetical, the mom has the child, the mom's a custodial parent, and between the mom and the dad, they kind of just informally say, okay, kid's going to stay with dad for a while. Because I've seen where that happens, that there may be a court order, but the parents just on their own, they say, well, let's just do things differently. We're friends now. Could that situation be a violation of one of these laws?
Right now.
Chair Burdick and Senator Ringo, I am not prepared to answer that question since I am not an attorney, although I am with the Department of Justice. We did have some deputy district attorneys and circuit court judges on our task force. I don't know if Mr. Taylor recalls any information about this or not, but I deferred to them as far as membership on this topic.
Well, Chair, members of the committee, I could read the statute. A person commits a crime of custodial interference in the second degree if knowing or having reason to know that the person has no legal right to do so, that person takes, entices, or keeps another person from another person's lawful custodian on violation of a valid joint custody order with the intent to hold the other person permanently or for a protracted period of time. So, Chairman of the Committee, Senator Ringo, I don't think under that scenario that you put forth that that person had permanently intended to permanently keep that person all for a protracted period of time.
Well, I used to volunteer at legal clinics where we heard a lot of horrible stories. This clinic did just domestic relations work, but I've heard plenty of stories where there was a custody order that gave control of the kids to one parent, and yet just between themselves, the parents reached a different agreement, and yet, you know, they never went to the court and got things changed. And I'm not just saying for a weekend, but for a long period of time. And I just want to know all the ramifications of what we're doing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that problem exists with the current statute. So what we're doing in this bill is extending out the statute of limitations. But I also think that the scenario you're putting forth, and Senator Brzezinski, I'm sure can chime in on this one too, is we're talking about intent here, too. I mean, someone has to have a certain amount of criminal intent here.
Oh,
and if there's an agreement between the parties, there wouldn't be an intent to create a criminal act here.
Well, I'm not so sure I agree with that. It seems to me it's intent to carry out the act, not the intent to commit a crime. And if you intend to take the kid for a year, even though the other... But I don't know. Frankly, I'm just asking the question. And I would want that clarified.
That is a good question, and maybe we could arrange for one of the lawyers who've been working on this to respond to Senator Ringo.
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, I'd be happy to carry that back.
Okay, thank you. That's good.
Are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. I don't want to cut off our next two witnesses, so we will just get started and see how far we get. And if we need any more, then we will do that. Andrea Meyer and Kelly Skye.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick. I'm with the committee, Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And OCDLA opposes this bill in large part because...
Excuse me, we have two bills before us, so could you be clear about which one?
Senate Bill 251. We are not taking a position on 252. It's really not an issue that we would become involved in. As to 251, which deals with extending the statute of limitations, at a policy level, we object to the extension of the statute of limitations on any offenses. And this committee discussed the issue of statute of limitations yesterday, and Senator Ringo and Senator Brzezinski eloquently put our concerns about extending the statute of limitations. So we object on that basis. Specifically as to this bill, I have two concerns that are sort of an answer to the way that I've heard there have been some really compelling testimony today, and I'm not sure that this bill will address a lot of the problems that were discussed before the committee today. One is that custodial interference is an ongoing offense. It's an offense that continues while the children are away from that custodial parent. So if a child is abducted by the other parent and they're gone for, say, 5 years, the statute of limitations isn't running. The parent can't just keep that child for 5 years and have the statute of limitations run and not be subject to prosecution. They're subject to prosecution as long as they are keeping those children away from that parent.
Madam Chair, can I just ask a question about that?
Yes.
Does that mean let's say that they never return the child. Does that mean that it's assumed that the crime of custodial interference ceases when the child turns 18?
I would think that, yes, that crime would cease when the child turns 18.
Well, then they would have until the child's 21 to prosecute.
Correct.
Thank
Correct.
You. Go ahead.
The other part of that is that I hear the witnesses concerned that the child is the victim and that the child should be able to report it when they realize the trauma that's occurred in their life. Oftentimes, this statute's going to have been told or at least begun by a report to law enforcement from the other parent. So we would be talking about cases where the other parent didn't even report that the children were gone, but that the child as an adult then reports it themselves. And it seems like such a narrow class of cases and an effort to solve such a broad problem with such a small fix, yet it extends this sort of piecemeal approach at extending the statute of limitations. It seems like every session we have different crimes, different situations where people feel that the statute of limitations should be extended, and that sort of piecemeal approach is something that we oppose.
Let me ask a question of clarification here. You're saying that if the other parent reports the abduction, then that starts the statute of limitations running. But if they report it and the abduction, you say the child is five, the abduction continues. Are you saying they'd have to report it again to start the clock running again?
Chair Burdick, no, that actually would, that's the first point that I was making, that no, it's a continuing crime, so the statute of limitations is not told yet. It has been reported, but it's not told. But when the child turns 18, if they've never been returned, at that point it would start, and I believe the current statute of limitations is 3 years on custodial interference.
Well, Madam Chair, the current statute is 3 years. The least this bill would do would increase it to 6 years,
right. Madam Chair. And, you know, when we talk about the victim attains the age of 24 or within 6 years after he's reported to law enforcement, so if the victim were six and it was reported six, it would be 12. There's another way. One of the interesting things here that I'm thinking in my own mind, and I was involved in the task force, I was staffer, is we could define victim for the purposes of this part to be the child. Unlike a lot of the other cases here, arguably you have two victims. One is the parent who has custody, and the other one is the child.
But according to that interpretation, which I see your underlinings and circlings here, mm-hmm. If they can just run out the clock, then, like if they, under current statute, are you saying that if they get abducted when they're six, and the other parent reports it, then by the time the child is nine, that they've run out the clock?
No. Madam Chairman of the Committee, the other thing we've heard, too, is Kelly has pointed out, it's an ongoing crime.
That's why
the kids
return
to 10. You would have, I guess, 3 years from the earlier the date of when it was reported or when the crime ceased. So assuming the report was when the kid was six, the crime ends when the kid is 10. That would, on the current law, would be 13.
Right.
Under this law, it would be, if this were amended, adopted, it would be 16. Assuming that there was a report, because if there were a report 6 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement agency, whichever occurs first. Otherwise, if it weren't reported, it would be when the victim, quote unquote, whoever the victim is, turned 24.
Okay, but I thought I heard a conflict that you're talking about cases where the abduction ends and then you have 3 years under current statute, 6 years under this one.
Okay. That's correct.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that.
So, Chair Burdick, that sort of exemplifies the complexity of the state of our statute of limitations. And as with the sex offenses that are already part of the statute that we're discussing, the statute of limitations, a report to law enforcement is a report by anybody. It could be the mandatory reporter, as we discussed yesterday. It could be the actual victim. It could be a parent, custodial, non-custodial. Anybody who reports it to law enforcement starts that statute of limitations. So that that statute of limitations. If the child's never returned, then, but it's reported by a parent, then when that child turns 18, the statute starts running, and when the child, you know, they have until the child's 21 to then prosecute. All of this to say that it's a complex expansion of the statute of limitations in an area that that already seems to be a pretty, has a very lengthy statute of limitations because it's an ongoing offense.
Thank you. We have just a couple minutes remaining. Do you need more time?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon, and I will simply echo what Kelly Sky said on behalf of OCDLA and point out one other thing to the committee. There is a bill over on the House side, I believe it's House Bill 2015, that would extend under this law the 24 years age limitation to 30 and the 6 years to 12, and so we're really concerned about not only the piecemeal approach to extending statute of limitations, the policy issues behind the need to have statute of limitations, but also what's just going on in this body, this session, that you may very well be looking at that issue as well, and all this needs to be taken into account, I think, when we consider this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of our remaining committee members? Thank you very much, and appreciate your testifying, Sean. I've heard this story before. It never ceases to move me, and I know I speak for the committee. So with that, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 251 and 252, and this committee is adjourned. Sorry.